Robin Young, it's here and now. Coming up, a conversation about Iran, why many Iranians looking across the border at Iraq like what they see. But first, for the first time since wars broke out in Afghanistan and Iraq, Congress began debate today on a defense spending bill that would include war costs. In the past, Congress has only approved emergency bills, like the supplemental bill the president just vetoed and Congress is scrambling to replace. The defense spending bill being debated today includes year-long funding for the wars and is virtually unrecognizable from the request President Bush submitted. House Democratic leaders have shifted priorities away from next-generation weapons and towards traditional military equipment and higher salaries for troops. The bill is also chock-filled with amendments, 50 of them, on issues ranging from videotaping detainee interrogations to offering contraceptives at military bases. Josh Rogan of Congressional Quarterly is covering the story. And Josh, this debate is expected to be significant. Why?
Well, Robin, this is simply the largest defense budget bill in real dollar terms since World War II. Also, this is the first bill since the Democrats have taken over power, and it's going to be, although a wide range of debates on many issues that simply haven't been discussed in many years.
Now, we understand the bill is going to take over, you know, be enacted after the three-month supplemental bill that's now being rehashed in Congress runs out. Is the bill, by the way, going to take up today's bill that's being debated? Is that taking up any of the contentious issues that have held up the supplemental bill, like troop withdrawal?
Well, interestingly, no. There's been a coordinated strategy between the Democratic leadership to place the most controversial things into the Iraq supplemental debate, which is also ongoing, in order to try to get this defense budget bill through the Congress as quickly as possible. There's a recognition that they don't need to fight both battles at the same time, but it remains to be seen whether or not the amendments will actually hold up the bill, stifling the strategy of the Democrats.
Because there are so many of them. Take us through some of the more controversial ones.
All right. Well, amongst the most controversial are the ones that address the status of detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Several amendments talk about videotaping interrogations, reporting on what the president's plan is to try detainees, and also releasing those detainees who are being held there but are not deemed to be dangerous to America anymore.
Yeah.
So another one that just came up was requiring contraceptives to be available for deployed troops. And while this is sort of a small issue in terms of money, this could be something that the Republicans could seize upon to stall the bill.
There's also an amendment, we understand, that would block future funding for any war in Iran. Your thoughts on that?
Well, there's actually two amendments. One would prevent any Iraq or Afghanistan money from being used to plan a military operation in Iran, and the other one would just state clearly that Congress hasn't authorized any military operations in Iran, and they would need to authorize them. So although these are policy amendments that don't really have any binding teeth in the beginning, they express the sense of Congress that they want to be in the debate before any action is taken in Iran.
The Democratic leadership, we also understand, gutted some of the programs the president and the Pentagon requested, which, as we said, were geared towards future military projects, reallocated those funds to current military operations. Can you take us through some of those?
Sure. And this will be the substance of what the debate will be over the next 2 days. We're talking about Democrats fundamentally shifting the priorities away from military modernization towards what they believe that the troops on the ground need today. So they cut funding in a major way for things like the Missile Defense Program or the Army's Future Combat Systems. These are large, multi-billion-dollar programs that will still go churning along, but will not have quite as much funding as they expected. Mm-hmm. And what the Democrats did is they placed the money into what they call military readiness, training, equipment for the National Guard, a pay raise. They also stifled an attempt by Bush to raise fees for military health care.
Well, Josh Rogan, this debate today is in the House. As you said, it's expected to continue for a couple of days. Then I presume it has to go to the Senate. What's the thinking? I mean, how many of these amendments and program changes are going to stay intact? What's the thinking of the bill as it's being debated now actually being the one that gets passed? And will a bill get passed?
Well, it's expected that the bill will get passed, but some of the more controversial amendments may not last through the conference between the Senate, especially the ones regarding contraception. Debate will go forward, and these 50 amendments represent what's left of 130 proposed. So most of the ones that are sponsored by Democrats are likely to go through, and some of the ones that were left over from Democrats will probably not be passed.
Well, Josh Rogan of Congressional Quarterly, no need to apologize. We thank you very much for your report, talking about the 2008 defense bill being debated today. Josh, thanks.
Thank you.
Iran is percolating on several fronts in the news. The country's hardline president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is calling on American troops to pack their bags and leave. Meanwhile, UN weapons inspectors paid a surprise visit to Iran on Sunday and concluded that Iran has made a leap in its goal of enriching uranium. At the same time, the U.S. agreed to hold talks with Iranian officials in Baghdad to see how Iran might use its influence to help end the war in Iraq. Well, a recent report in the Boston Globe says that influence is a two-way street, that Iraqis have impressed many Iranians with Iraq's separation of church and state. Boston Globe Middle East Bureau Chief Anne Barnard wrote this week's story. She joins us now. And Anne, let's talk about the news first. The U.S. and Iran are going to meet, but that announcement came before the news from U.N. inspectors of a leap in developing uranium in Iran. That's got to be unsettling to U.S. officials. Put this moment in context.
The U.S.-Iran relationship is very complex and contradictory right now. On the one hand, there is a confrontation brewing over Iran's nuclear program. But on the other hand, Iran is the country that has the most in common with the United States on Iraq. The Sunni extremists who are responsible for the most deaths of American soldiers are also the ones who are killing dozens, sometimes hundreds of Shiites every day. So both the U.S. and Iran would like to see those groups curbed. On the other hand, the U.S. at the same time accuses Iran of supporting violent groups in Iraq, perhaps to undermine the very government that it also, on the surface, supports. Now, why would Iran do that? Because Iran might not want a very strong Shiite-led state next door that could emerge as an alternative to Iran, which is right now the only Shiite-led government in the world.
And yet, let's explain further, the Shiite-led state, and this goes to your writing, the Shiite-led state in Iraq is not an imposed Shiite state as it is in Iran.
That's right. Iran is a theocracy where there are elections, there are parliamentary debates, but real power rests in the hands of Shiite clerics who appoint the supreme leader. In Iraq, the Shiites are in charge of the government only because they're the majority in the country and they won in democratic elections. So it's a very different model for Shiite empowerment. For a long time, the Iranian Islamic Revolution was the only model for Shiite empowerment. Now there is a problematic but democratic alternative emerging in Iraq.
And as you point out, the Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who is the Shiite leader in Iraq, practices something called quietism. Explain that.
There's a long tradition in Shiite theology that Shiite clerics should not get involved directly in government. That's because religious Shiites believe the Mahdi, who is a religious leader from the early Islamic period who disappeared, will come back and establish the perfect Islamic state on earth. And until then, Shiite religious leaders should not get involved in earthly affairs like politics. Now, Sistani in Iraq has played an important role in politics, but behind the scenes, and he has not advocated having an Islamic government actually run by Shiite clerics in Iraq.
And you write that some Iranians that you met are intrigued by what you're calling and what you just described as this sort of freewheeling experiment in Shiite empowerment, which they're watching take place across the border in Iraq. What are some of the things they're saying to you? What are they seeing happening, for instance, in mosques with imams, that's in contrast to Iran?
First of all, the main thing that Iranians say when they look at Iraq is, we don't want democracy if it comes with this much violence.
Right.
So the democratic domino effect that the Bush administration was looking for, where democracy would be ushered in Iraq and everyone else in the region would want to emulate it, has not quite materialized. On the other hand, there are aspects of life in Iraq that are democratic and open in a way that's very new for the Middle East, and certainly in great contrast to Iran. For instance, in Iraq, anyone can say what they like in Friday prayers, which is the main prayer day of the Muslim week. Anyone can open a mosque. Anyone can follow their own theology. Whereas in Iran, the government controls what's said in the mosques. There is only one mosque in every city that holds a Friday sermon, and those sermons are determined and monitored by the state. So many Shiites who supported the Islamic Revolution in 1979 in Iran now are critical of the government there because they feel the government has become just like any other government, corrupt, not allowing the people to have enough of a voice. It's not the government of Islamic religious freedom that they had hoped for. Mm-hmm. When they look at Iraq, they're seeing a way that Shiites can have religious freedom, can be freed from the oppression of living under Sunni rule or under rule that, that represses Shiite rituals. And yet, it's not a government-controlled religion.
When you say when they look at Iraq, they literally look at Iraq. I was surprised to see that as many as 1,500 Iranians a day travel to Iraq on pilgrimage.
For centuries, this has gone on. It was curtailed when there were very bad relations between Saddam Hussein and the Iranian government. But when Saddam fell, immediately there was a lot of traffic both directions. Iranians went to Iraq, Iraqis went to Iran, and there was a lot. This religious and cultural exchange was reborn and really flowered.
One of the merchants who's made one of these pilgrimages told you that he saw Ali Sistani's home and something there impressed him.
He is a respected donor to Islamic causes and to Islamic charities. He has started to give his money to Sistani rather than to the clerics in the Iranian religious center of Rum, because he was so impressed when he went to Iraq and he saw Sistani receiving respectful visits from prominent Iraqi politicians who were coming to him voluntarily, not because he was the head of state, because he has no governmental role, but because he was a respected religious leader. To him, it was a model of how clerics could be respected and religion could be respected without being controlled by the government.
Hmm. We should point out that we're reading also about Iraqis who are going to Iran to get away from the violence in Iraq. What are they seeing there that may surprise them?
This phenomenon is definitely a two-way street. There are at least 750,000 Iraqis who have visited Iran since Saddam fell, and this has been an amazing opportunity for Iran to gain public relations points. Now Iraqis look next door to Iran. They may have been afraid of Iran before because it was a country they fought a long and bloody war with. Now they look at it and they say, this is a well-organized country, it's a peaceful country, it may have more restrictions on freedom of speech, on religion, than we do in Iraq, but it's safe, I don't feel afraid, I know that I'm not going to be killed at a Sunni checkpoint, the garbage is going to be picked up, and that things are organized. Many visiting Iraqis said to me, wow, maybe the way Iran is run is a good model for Iraq.
That's Ann Barnard, Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, about how Iran is influencing Iraq and vice versa. Iranians like what they see in Iraq, and that clerics are not at least formally involved in Iraqi government. Clerics like Muqtada al-Sadr do have a lot of influence, but Iraq is not a theocracy. Iraqis, as she just said, going to Iran to escape violence and to get some order in their lives. When we come back, we'll talk more with Anne about how Iranians feel about Americans. And later in the program, we're going to speak to the Reverend Mel White. He worked closely with the late Jerry Falwell. In fact, he was ghostwriter for his autobiography. Very close until Mel came out as a gay man. He's going to talk to us about his conflicted feelings today after Jerry Falwell has passed, how he hates the homophobia that Jerry Falwell unleashed, but loved the man in many ways. Back after a quick break, here and now. Young, it's here and now, and we're looking at how Iraqis and Iranians, former enemies, are now eyeing each other across their mutual borders. Since the fall of Saddam Hussein, Iranians have been making pilgrimages to shrines in Iraq. Now Iraqis are going to Iran, and each group likes what they see. We're speaking with Ann Barnard, Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. She's been traveling in the region recently, writing about this two-way street of influence. And Ann, I want to talk a little more about this. I mean, you have Iranians looking at Iraq and saying maybe this country that has no state-imposed religion, that has some democracy, although chaotic and often violent, is better than what I have in Iran. You have Iraqis saying of Iran, it's organized, it's disciplined, it's secure, it's not so bad. Where is this headed?
Right now, the real question is whether Iran and Iraq will be able to build a constructive relationship. And again, this comes back to the meeting with the United States. The United States and Iran really need to pull in the same direction in Iraq if things are going to improve there, especially in southern Iraq, where Iran has a lot of influence because it's mostly Shiite area. So ultimately, it's up to these two governments to stop fighting and making Iraq and leaving Iraq stuck in the middle. as for the grassroots influence back and forth, it's a very natural phenomenon, and I think on some level the grass is certainly greener on the other side. In both cases, people are suffering, but in very different ways, and they're both dissatisfied with their situation and seeing that there are alternatives.
But you do talk to someone, again, this is a merchant, who says what happens in Iraq would be impossible in Iran. Why? Why did he say that?
In Iran, people have become apathetic. They've sort of given up on trying to influence their government. And even though there is, people are not afraid to speak in the street or to a reporter of their dissatisfaction. It's very dangerous to organize an opposition party, for instance, in Iran. Any kind of anything that the government is going to see as political activity is going to be dangerous. People can be put in jail. People can lose their livelihoods. So the man in the bazaar said to me, the Iraqis, when they were oppressed, they fought back. And he was referring to uprisings against Saddam Hussein. And then, whereas here in Iran, we've become sheep. We have just listened to our government and we've given up.
Right. And by the way, what are some of the other things? I mean, as long as we have you, you've spent so much time in the region and we're just in Tehran. What are some other snapshots that you come up with? I mean, your conversations in the bazaar with these merchants are one, but, you know, what are some of the other things you're seeing in Iran and what do they tell you?
I think that most Americans don't understand how complex a place Iran is, and I certainly didn't before I went there. I mean, the main image we have of Iran is of clerics in turbans, of crowds shouting death to Israel. When you go there, in fact, many people are not involved in that kind of political display. They're worried about their own families. They're worried about making money. They're disillusioned with the Islamic Revolution of 1979. Many of them just want Iran to become more open to the rest of the world. Now, those people definitely don't want foreign power coming in and upsetting their government because they see what happened next door in Iraq, and they're afraid that chaos would follow. But they're very dissatisfied with their government, and they're not afraid to say so, which is something surprising about Iran. I think also people are getting disillusioned with Ahmadinejad because even though people turned to him because they felt that the reformists who were trying to democratize Iran had failed to do that and had failed to improve the economy, and they turned to Ahmadinejad for an alternative, now they also find that he has not created jobs, he's not brought the economy up. In fact, there's great fear in Iran that soon the oil subsidies that give everyone cheap energy and cheap gasoline, that there's going to be a huge price hike for those commodities, and people are terrified about what the impact on the economy will be. So there's a lot of uncertainty about the future, and people's main concern is their livelihood, the economy, and the future of the 75% of the population that is young and looking ahead without a clear picture of how they're going to make a living.
Hmm. And just speaking of Ahmadinejad, he said this week of President Bush, the superpowers cannot prevent us from owning this nuclear technology. If they want to strike us militarily, I say their use of these practices will be gone forever. The Iranian people can protect themselves and retaliate. You know, given that, how are you treated as an American?
Again, there's a big disconnect between the way the government sounds in its rhetoric and the way people act. People are always very welcoming to me as an American. Many people have a relative in America, in Los Angeles or in New York or somewhere. So people are generally very curious about America. They often ask questions, does America really hate Iran? Is America going to bomb Iran? But there's very little personal animus against me as an American. There are exceptions. The people that are involved in the Revolutionary Guards or the Basiji, which is a militia, sort of volunteer militia attached to the Revolutionary Guards, where people get financial benefits and political benefits for being part of the loyalists to the regime. Those people have a fixed idea about America that's very negative. But most ordinary Iranians, they might be critical of American policy. They might be afraid that there's going to be a confrontation between Iran and the United States, but they're quite friendly towards Americans.
Ann Barnard, Middle East Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe, speaking to us about Iran. She just was visiting Tehran. And I just want to ask you quickly about a change you're about to make. We understand the Boston Globe is closing all of its foreign bureaus. You're going to be going to the New York Times and leaving the region. How do you feel about leaving the region?
Well, I'm very sorry to be leaving. I think now is not the time that we need less reporting out of the Middle East and about Iran and the rest of the Middle East. This is a time when we need more different voices and as many different outlets covering the region as possible, so that there are different perspectives available. So I hope that journalistic outlets will be able to keep covering foreign news. Certainly the Globe is doing its best with limited resources, and they were not happy either about making the decision. But I do hope that the media finds a way to continue funding this kind of work.
Well, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, some military parents face another battle when they return home. They've lost custody of their children while they were deployed overseas, and they're asking lawmakers for help. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, your letters and the legacy of Jerry Falwell. To some, he stood for family values. To others, he was the face of the American Taliban. How does a gay man, who was once a close friend, view him now? That's after the news, Here and Now. Supreme Young, it's Here and Now. Last night in their second debate, Republicans running for the White House said nothing about Jerry Falwell, the founding father of the religious right and the moral majority, who died yesterday. Some candidates did praise Falwell before the event, but they were asked by moderator Britt Hume of Fox News to not comment during the event. Too bad, because that could have been interesting. Falwell began the moral majority in the 70s when fundamentalist Christians spurned politics and discussion of faith was largely a no-no. He left this world with Republican and Democratic candidates falling over each other to assert their religious credentials. Well, joining us on the line is the Reverend Dr. Mel White, former ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell and other evangelical leaders. Mel split with Falwell in 1994. He announced he was gay and founded his own ministry called Soul Force. Mel, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Robin.
And, you know, I want to extend my condolences, because even though you are a gay man and Jerry Falwell is considered, you know, one of the leading homophobes in this country, this is a loss for you, I understand.
Yeah, I was in the dentist chair getting a crown when I was told. And so my tears, I wasn't quite sure where their source was, whether it was a dentist chair or this terrible news, but I really did cry for his family. He was a good dad and a good husband, a good grandfather, and I cried for his church. I mean, he has 25,000 people, and they loved him as pastor, and, you know, I sat in his church Sunday after Sunday and watched him pastor, and, of course, he has 27,000 or so students, and but I also cried for all my brothers and sisters who, you know, gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender, who are such victims of his rhetoric against us. And I felt really sad that I didn't have a chance to shape Falwell, to get him to change, to get him to apologize, to say that God loves his gay children too. But
you really thought you could do that. We should say you continued to attend his church, as you said. You even moved across from the church. What was your thinking, that you could change his mind?
Well, the statistics are clear, Robin, that people don't change their mind until they know somebody who is gay or lesbian. They don't. And the empirical data doesn't mean anything, the biblical data doesn't mean anything, but they change when they start seeing that we aren't like what Jerry Falwell says. And so we moved here thinking that they would see us as a gay couple, and they've seen us for 4 years now. Jerry did change, you know. He was a racist during the 50s and 60s. He called it the Civil Wrongs Movement, but in 64... he apologized for his racism, opened his doors to his church. So if he can change on that issue, I was hoping he could change on ours.
But he changed on another one, too, staying with that civil rights era. At the time, he also argued that other ministers should stay out of politics, meaning the civil rights movement. But a decade later, he said this idea of religion and politics don't mix was invented by the devil to keep Christians from running their own country. And that's when he became an activist. By the way, what caused him to change his thinking then?
Well, I think he was most disturbed about abortion rights.
This was Roe v. Wade in 1973.
Yeah, I think the Roe v. Wade thing really set him off. And then the gain of homosexuals, we were gaining such visibility that he couldn't stand it anymore. So he went political to try to make this a Christian nation once again in reality, as he sees it.
Well, how did you work with him? I mean, obviously when you worked with him as a ghostwriter, you had not come out yet. But even afterwards, I mean, how did you interact? What did he say to you? How did he treat you?
Well, when I worked for him, when I wrote, you know, I really was working for Simon Schuster as their ghostwriter for his biography, and I thought he was right about homosexuality. I thought at that time I was sick and sinful, and I was in a marriage, and we were counseling for 20 years. We'd been counseling, and then I slit my wrists and came out of the hospital. My wife said, you're gay. I like gay people. I just didn't want you to be one. So I came back as a gay man and went to Falwell and said, you know, what you're doing is hurting gay people. And at first he was really open. In 1999, 200 of our folks met with 200 of his folks, but he got dumped on by other religious leaders like Tim LaHaye and Gary Bauer and Pat Robertson. So from that one time when he looked like he was opening up, he closed down again, and he's gotten more histrionic ever since.
Well, I was wondering, it's interesting to note the change of attitude in the Republican Party towards Jerry Falwell over the past few years. Just want your thoughts on that. He was asked to pray from the podium at the Republican National Convention in 2000. Some say that 4 years later, the Associated Press points out he was quietly let in and out of the convention in 2004. Maybe there was a statement there. But on the other hand, John McCain, who vilified Jerry Falwell as the agent of intolerance during the 2000 presidential campaign, last year went to him practically hat in hand, you know, begging for his endorsement or his forgiveness. Where do you think, you know, what will his legacy be? What when he, as he leaves at this point in history?
I think his legacy, Robin, is that he's left America firmly in the hands of fundamentalists. That the Christian church, the denominations are all divided, fundamentalists versus progressives, that even the Roman Catholic Church is in a kind of schism over him. He had tremendous influence. He set these strict fundamentalist standards, and then he took that political. And in taking it political, trying to superimpose his ideology on the rest of us, that's, I think that spirit is really alive and well, because it's so well organized now. And even without his presence, physical presence, his fundamentalist spirit is really at work in the country, both in the churches and in government. So I think his legacy is he left this terrible memory of a country that is struggling to find what democracy means again, and a place where it's inclusive.
But I want to jump in to say the Washington Post today points out that Falwell and other evangelicals such as Pat Robertson, Bob Jones, represent a small fraction of evangelicals, a fraction that's dying out.
I think the Washington Post has been wrong before, and I think they're really wrong now. You talk to any of the experts who monitor the Christian right, they lost the election, and that made people think they were no longer powerful, and now if they don't find a candidate in this one, they still haven't found one, they will think that they're no longer powerful. But the Council on National Policy is meeting every month. That's their secret organization that where all these heads of state get together, heads of organizations. And I think that the fundamentalism and their political arm is so organized that when they do come back, they will show the Washington Post is wrong.
So you have a very complicated view, just briefly, you know, describing someone who's been so divisive. Will you miss him?
Yeah, the irony is that there's a sense of relief, too, that we've lost one of the major faces of homophobia in the country with a huge media outlet. The idea that I will miss him as a person is true, because I'd still hope to influence him, but I will not miss his presence in the political and religious scenes at all. I think we all should breathe a sigh of relief that this just giant of intolerance has passed from the scene, and that there's no one really out there to replace him. So I have to, it sounds really cruel, because I love the guy, maybe as God loved him, but I hated what he did. It's the old thing, I love the sinner, but I hated his sins.
Reverend Dr. Mel White, the former ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell and other evangelical leaders, I'm struck by, you know, he might have said the same thing of you.
Oh, he said the same thing of me 100 times all over the world.
Dr. White, thanks so much.
Sure, Robin.
Mel White, he came out as a gay man in 1994. He founded his own ministry called Soul Force, which ministers to gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people. But he still attends the church founded by Jerry Falwell. Later in the show, from helping Bob Dylan to discovering Nick Drake, we'll look at the career of music producer Joe Boyd. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, it's time to hear from you. Judy Chamberlain wrote, after our conversation with bioethicist Arthur Kaplan, who called for better health care for the mentally ill, but also said that the Virginia Tech shootings reinforced his feeling that the mentally ill had too many rights, that, for instance, institutions should be able to hold them longer for evaluations. That outraged Judy, who's with the advocacy group the National Empowerment Center in Lawrence, Massachusetts. She writes, "What about the minimum wage worker who loses her job because she can't show up because she's locked up for evaluation? Civil rights are not negotiable. The answer isn't forcing people. It's offering help in a way they're willing to accept. People are turning their lives around because of the support they get in peer-run programs. This is the real untold story in mental health." Well, we also spoke recently with Dr. Catherine Hill, Director of Research for the American Association of University Women. Their study claims women are still making less money than their male counterparts. Well, Melissa Craig from Cambridge, Massachusetts, wondered if wardrobe might be a factor.
In the 70s and 80s, we worked so hard for equal pay. We did it by doing good work and dressing professionally. Now, women at work dress like streetwalkers, and I can't imagine that does a lot for their credibility or their paycheck.
Why do I think we'll be following up on Melissa's follow-up? Well, moving on, many of you hated energy expert Vahan Janjigian's suggestion that there be a gas tax to raise the price of fuel and subsequently drive down the demand. Julia Rose of Allentown, New Jersey, let it rip in her response. She writes, "The plan is fatally skewed to the rich. I'm poor. I want to help the environment, but I live 30 miles from work with no carpooling or public transit available. I used to ride my bike 64 miles a day to work and back until I realized that I was spending more on childcare than saving on fuel. 40% of my weekly budget goes to gas. I can't even drive my kids to state parks anymore. If you really want to influence behavior, sock it to the arrogant SUV drivers and the arrogant American car companies who make them. I'm sick of being preached to reduce my carbon footprint when those arrogant jerks are doing triple the damage that my 5-year-old car will ever do. I'm sorry that I can't see the forest through the trees right now. I'm too busy wondering what else I can cut out of my budget to make the oil companies richer." Well, many of you wrote to thank us for having journalist Michael Pollan on to explain how farm subsidies are flooding the market with things like corn syrup. Mara Zimmersheed in Washington State wrote, "Wow, thank you. I've been wondering why corn syrup, which I dislike for its dull sweetness, is everywhere. While sugar beet processing factories are closing here in Washington State and in Colorado. I wish the sugar beet farmers got more help. They are as worthy of support as corn farmers." And finally, remember our piece on Benjamin Bagby, whose one-man, one-heart performance of the ancient epic Beowulf has been released on DVD. Well, who knew how many others were jumping on the Beowulf bandwagon, including Heidi Duckworth of the Collage Dance Theater of Los Angeles. She's on the line. And Heidi, you put Beowulf on ice?
We didn't wear skates, so we slid on the ice. And the audience also came onto the ice rink and watched it. You know, it's a cold northern myth, so I wanted them to have a visceral feeling of what it would be like to be up north.
And there I am looking at Beowulf sliding across the ice. And do I understand that you brought in Grendel, the monster, initially you brought her in on a Zamboni?
That's correct. We did. The Zamboni was Grendel's mother. So birthed Grendel right there smack onto the ice.
For those who don't have skating in the region, the Zamboni is the big machine that cleans the ice.
Right.
Well, now, what are you planning for the future?
We open at Red Cat here in Los Angeles at end of July with a new section where the dragons are played by real estate developers.
And I understand there's a hip-hop version.
That's it, and hip-hop runs throughout it.
Yeah. What's the appeal of Beowulf?
You know, it certainly is appealing today, and I think it's because it asks the question, what is a hero?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Heidi.
You're welcome, Robin. Thank you for inviting me.
And this is what Beowulf on Ice sounded like. We'd love to hear from you. Our address is letters at here-now.org, or you can call 617-358-0397. Straight ahead, from Nick Drake to Eric Clapton, the work of Uber music producer Joe Boyd, Here and Now. Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Joe Boyd's first job as a music producer was to bring blues great Muddy Waters to Britain. Later, he plugged in Bob Dylan's guitar at that 1965 Newport Folk Festival. One of the stories of that time is that Pete Seeger, so offended by the noise, yanked it back out. And Joe Boyd's first session as a record producer was this artist. Maybe you recognize the guitar. That's Eric Clapton on guitar, Stevie Winwood on vocals, the group powerhouse, the song Crossroads. Joe Boyd also produced Pink Floyd's first single. He worked with the incredible string band, discovered, produced, and maybe let down Nick Drake, produced Maria Muldaur's Midnight at the Oasis, and now he's writing about all of it in his memoir, White Bicycles, Making Music in the 1960s. We spoke with him when he was in Boston to speak at Harvard and began by asking, how would he define what a music producer does?
It's changed. Today, it's a very technical process, and the producer helps the artist get something technically very perfect. In the 60s, you listened, and you told the artists, great take, do it again, do it faster. You were the ears.
Were you the creator as well? Is there a Svengali element to it?
Not really. I mean, I think some producers, like Phil Spector, obviously wrote arrangements, and they had a very clear vision. My rule was to try and get out of the way and let artists express themselves and then put a lot of energy into the mix.
Well, there's so many stories, how many to talk about, but I want to ask you about Dylan at Newport because, you know, it would seem you can't hear this story enough, but the problem is you hear it from different people telling it in different ways. You were there. Do you plug the guitar in?
Well, I was on stage supervising the setting up of the stage. I supervised the sound check before it went on. I went out and bought a little fluorescent pink pen. And everything else for every other group was marked down on a piece of paper where the mics went and what the balances were. But the Dylan, we had a pink fluorescent pen that glowed in the dark, so we would be sure that from the first note it would be right. And it was incredibly exciting. It was the generational conflicts. There were cultural tectonic plates shifting. It was an amazing weekend.
Well, you know, to put it in a less elegant way, there were people booing. Let's listen to a little of the electric version of Maggie's Farm. So what was happening behind the scenes? Because we hear the story that Pete Seeger tried to pull the plug out. What happened?
I listened out in the audience to the first song, and then I went, somebody said, they're looking for you backstage. And I came back, and there were these three angry men, Seeger, Alan Lomax, and Theodore Bickel. I said, you've got to turn the sound down. I said, I can't turn it down. The sound control's out in the middle of the audience. So they made me go out there and ask the sound to be turned down. And, of course, Peter Yarrow, who was from Peter, Paul, and Mary, who was also a director of the Newport Festival, said, tell them that the board is adequately represented at the sound controls and that the representative here thinks the sound is just fine. And then he said, and tell them, and he lifted the middle finger of his right hand.
There you go. Well, let's fast forward to London, 1967. You were an active part of the underground there, the London Free School. Had noble ambitions to give free classes to London's poor. And this is where you came in contact with Pink Floyd. We have a copy of the CD that was released in Britain to go along with your memoir. It has the song you produced with Pink Floyd. It's called Arnold Lane. It's kind of a bit of an adult theme.
Well, in fact, it's folk music because Syd Barrett grew up in a house in Cambridge, which is a university town. His mother rented out rooms to girl students.
This is guitarist Syd Barrett, who died last year.
Yeah, yes. Singer, guitarist, songwriter of Arnold Lane. And so there was always washing on the line in the back of the house. And some of the times the students would say, wait a minute, I had six knickers hanging out there. There's only five now. Then there was a court case about a guy who was caught stealing underwear. So this is actually a song that comes out of the, you know, the formative years of Syd Barrett.
And the real-life backyard knicker sniffer. Let's listen.
On the wall hung a tall mirror. Distorted view. See-through baby blue.
you know, memories of working with Syd Barrett?
He had a wonderful, bright-eyed smile. He was intelligent. After he died, they played a little tape of him being interviewed just before he kind of cracked up, and he sounds really clear, really concise, really intelligent. And then a few weeks later, somebody said he took acid every day for 7 days, and he was never the same.
That brings us to Nick Drake, the beautiful singer of the 60s, 70s, who died at his own hand. Whether or not it was suicide or drug overdose, no one knows. Who had his fame posthumously when his song Pink Moon was used in the Volkswagen commercial, and now he's got a huge following. First of all, I want to listen to a little of his Pink Moon just to remind people who we're talking about.
I saw it written and I saw it say, Pink Moon is on its way. None of you stand so tall. Pink Moon.
Nick was amazingly talented. I was convinced that all you had to do was do a record and everybody would come. And the fact that he was so shy that he had no chat, no jokes, he had to retune his guitar between every song, I thought we could overcome that. But we didn't. We made two records that I thought were wonderful. They didn't sell. And it really crushed him.
We recently took a look at a new biography, yet another biography of Nick Drake.
Oh, Trevor Dan.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, because...
Okay. Yeah, sure. No, listen.
He's one of many who question whether or not, you know, you might have let Nick Drake down. You know, how what do you...
Well, if I let Nick Drake down, I let him down in the sense that I didn't figure out a way to present him. There were so many things that I thought of later of what I could have done or not done, not so much about Nick as his personal life. I had very little to do with Nick's personal life, but with his professional life, how I could have gotten him across, because I think that would have made him very happy and he wouldn't have been so depressed. He really wanted his music to reach lots of people.
Underneath, you know what? You have nothing. Dreams that came to you when so young.
Joe Boyd's book is White Bicycles. By the way, I know you're going to speak to Harvard students.
I am.
What do they ask you, and what do you want them to know?
I feel a bit guilty talking to students because when I was starting out in the 60s, life was incredibly easy. It was a time of great prosperity, and there was a huge gap between what you need, how much work you needed to do and how to pay the rent on an apartment in Harvard Square or Greenwich Village or Berkeley. It's one of the problems our society has, that students who are my age, you know, who are 22, the age when I was taking Muddy Waters to Europe, are worrying about their mortgage, you know, worrying about getting on a retirement plan and worrying about getting on the career ladder. It's a shame, but there are definitely entrepreneurs out there doing exactly the equivalent of what I was doing then, working on MySpace or whatever it is, whatever the new way to be original is. You know, people are doing it.
Joe Boyd, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
Well, you know you can't spend what you ain't got. You can't lose what you ain't never had.
Muddy Waters. Joe Boyd spoke to us when he was visiting Boston recently. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
I got busted, boys, ain't that sad?
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.